I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell. And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
So, the people's supper. What is it?
Great question. So the People's Supper is an initiative to bring people together, both for purposes of healing, but also across the divides and the things that separate us. And we're bringing people together in living rooms across the country to really be in a different kind of conversation with one another.
Where did that idea come from?
So, I mean, it was an idea that emerged from all three of us, really. I think, you know, in my work, even before the election happened, we were just watching a tremendous amount of what I would honestly call grieving happening. People were grieving what they saw as these tremendous divides between each other, and this just the tremendous assaults on who they were, right? We heard about, you know, deporting people. We were hearing about, you know, grabbing women by the crotch. We were getting stories from women who were grabbed by the crotch and told, you know, well, if our presidential candidate can do it, so can I. And I just thought, you know, we can't sit here in all of this. And at the time, we all thought Hillary was going to win. And so we thought, you know, well, maybe this would have some sort of ending. And it was so clear to me this wasn't going to end. There was no ending to this, that something had actually ruptured or potentially always been ruptured that had come into sight. And so we started to think about what healing might look like post-election. And the only thing that I could really equate it to was grief. And that's when I called Lennon.
I think it's interesting because, you know, I think all of us are part of very different communities in very different places.
Yeah.
And some of what we noticed, and now particularly in retrospect, is realizing that there were a couple of patterns of what people were craving. And within our community, and in the immediate aftermath of that election moment, but also, as Emily said, preceded. You know, it was 2016, all you could talk about was the election and the divisiveness and the polarization and the heart of everything that was showing up in people's personal news feeds and on the news. And so there was a lot that was being carried before November 8th, and then the election happened. And for a lot of folks within our community, they, you know, woke up in a grief state, you know, and in a world that they didn't expect to live in. And one that, you know, both came as a surprise and for a lot of people an assault, and one that was born and bred a lot of real senses of fear of what that meant. But there was this other experience that we were often hearing from people, oftentimes different people, and a very different need that was being expressed. And that was this desire to actually break out of what they had discovered to be their own kind of echo chambers, right? And that people were finding themselves immersed in communities that looked the same, believed the same things. And suddenly there was this moment, whether born of having family or friends who voted differently and not knowing how to have that conversation, or actually not knowing anybody with a different kind of political orientation, there was this real desire to hear, right? And to recognize that, you know, like, there are fewer bad people than the news media would have us believe in this moment, and a desire to, you know, understand other. And I think both of those things coexisted, but they're separate needs and needed separate containers with which to be held.
Yeah, and I'm a preacher in the Black church tradition, and so, you know, in the post-election moment, I was thinking a lot about this idea of apocalypse and not like the end of the world, Transformers, like some robots are coming from outer space to come, but the Greek root of the word apocalypse actually means to uncover. And in the post-election moment, I think what was uncovered for all of us to see was just how deep the ruptures are at the heart of our democracy, and even in an interpersonal level, in our relationships to one another. And so the question for me became, you know, as somebody who is a woman of faith, who is a clergy woman, I think a lot about the book of Isaiah and the call to be repairers of the breach. And it's clear to me that our nation is existing at a time where there's a lot of wounded people, and hurt people tend to hurt people. And so the question then becomes, you know, how do we begin to see each other again? And that's when I called Lennon, who's driving from Nashville, Tennessee to Little Rock, Arkansas in a panic. And I was calling Lennon, I was like, what can we do? You do dinner really well. I know something about setting like sacred space. Emily's a rock star at communications. Let's think what we might be able to do together.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing that what you just said there, the idea people who hurt others, and yet the three of you wanted to bring them together to sort of not hurt. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I mean, I can speak somewhat to that. I think that the experiences that hurt us most and where we feel the most hurt and are most and instinctually driven to hide, right, and to cover up and to project an image in the world that is one of strength and one of everything is fabulous or fine or I am fine, yeah, right, and kind of a hardening, right, that actually opening up about our wounds, about our real vulnerabilities, about the things that we fear, the questions that we're holding, the hard part of the lived experience and a shared human story can be some of the most amazing breeding ground for actually developing real relationships, right? And for listening to each other differently and suddenly changing the assumptions that we carried about one another when suddenly you see that kind of human vulnerability. So I think in different ways, all of us have used hurt throughout kind of our organizations as kind of a genesis point for building connection and empowerment.
And thinking about the role of healing in particular, so I think about the fact that, you know, we predominantly work with people of color in the South and LGBT folks through our organization, and the reality is a lot of people are hurt because their lived experience is about encountering and being misunderstood, being oppressed, being marginalized just because of who they are.
Right.
And so for me, I remember election night, I was crying on the floor of my kitchen, and my lovely husband, it was before the polls had even closed in the Midwest, and I remember rocking back and forth and just saying, I don't feel safe, I don't feel safe, I don't feel safe. And I could feel this presence, my mom passed away a year ago, surround me and just say, you know, baby, we ain't never been safe. And so the question then becomes, and this is one thing we've talked about a lot, is in a time when there is no such thing as a safe space, what does it mean for us to be brave? And our friend Mickey Scott Bay Jones, who works with us at the People's Supper, talks about brave space as the space between individual and personal transformation that happens when we sit down and we are willing to be vulnerable enough with each other, realizing everybody has the potential to both wound and be wounded.
Right.
And what we can bring to a table, to a dinner, is the reality of wanting to move perhaps not beyond the hurt, but move towards a more collective wholeness, because there's so much pain in the world. And I think it's only through our relationships that we can do that.
Do you think, you said safe space. Does the People's Supper aim to provide a safe space?
No.
Because I think there is no such thing as
a safe space.
We aim to provide brave space, right?
Yeah.
Which is what Jen is speaking to, right? Which is, I mean, truly, there is never going to be a space that is fully safe. And I think that there is that invitation there, right? Well, what does it mean? Does it mean that we just can't talk to one another, you know, if we can't be safe? And I think at Hollaback, we do a lot of work around online harassment, and we've just seen the ways in which over time people have developed these very wide but thin networks online, and the ways in which that has erupted into hatred and divisiveness. And the 2016 election was just the height of that, right? More than ever, we were divided. And if you weren't divided amongst your friends, you were divided by, you know, bots that were coming out of the woodwork to harass you from both parties.
Right.
And so, you know, there was this instinct, I think, that we had, but also I feel like that the world is having right now, to be like, wait a minute, like our grandparents' generation didn't have their entire social lives online. Like they actually sat down, and maybe they sat down and, you know, quilting circles with people who looked and thought just like them. That's not what we want, right? But can we sit down in circles with people who don't look or think just like us? And what would that look like, and what would that mean? And I think that was foundational to what we started to think about when we thought about the People's Supper, and also what we think about when we think about Brave Space, because there's nothing easy about sitting down with people
Absolutely.
Who are totally ideologically, identity-wise different than you.
Yeah.
You know, that's real. That's real substantive work. There's nothing easy about these dinners that we're having, but there's also nothing that's more important.
And for me, it's deeply spiritual. I believe, as a Christian, as a clergywoman, that everyone is made in the image of God. And man, did this election make it hard to see the God presence in everyone, right? And so one of my constant questions, both theologically and spiritually, is how do I get to know more about God by getting to know people who are different than me? Because if we each have a little bit of that God presence, that spiritual presence, that light in the world, I don't have all of it. You don't have all of it. Lennon doesn't have all of it. But what does it mean to see the light in people that it's not so easy to see the light in?
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the work of the People's Supper is being able to truly see people as people and not as their Twitter feed or their Facebook feed or a number of other things. We've become so walled off that the fact that us having dinners is a revolutionary idea when people have been gathering around dinner tables time immoral, like for millennia, is so interesting to me.
So why a dinner?
Well, I think part of it is exactly to Jen's point, that humans have been gathering not necessarily around tables, but over meals for millennia. Whoever you are, wherever you come from, there is some cultural experience and familiarity within a family and beyond it of actually gathering over food, right? And the rituals that we attach to food create a space that instantly is intimate, right? Or that carries kind of a warmth to it that doesn't necessarily, evoke the same kind of experience if you're sitting in a room with cold lighting and a plastic chair and you're, going to go around formally in a circle. And I think that there are moments also, food allows us to see the cultures that we come from. It allows us to see into the places from which we emerge, right? And one of the things that we've encouraged a lot of folks to do is to bring all of our suppers of potluck, right? And everyone desires to contribute in some way, and we encourage folks either to cook together or to bring in a dish with a story behind it, something that was a favorite food, something that they learned from somebody else in their families or their community, something with a history, and that becomes kind of an entry point into seeing a different part of ourselves and our stories that don't necessarily come up every day in conversation.
Right. So was the idea to bring people of differing political views, differing genders together, or just any differences and get some people in a room together and have a meal?
Yeah, well, I think the idea was twofold, right? So first and foremost, the work of bridge building, whoever you are, it is not everyone's work, and it is not everyone's work right now.
Yeah.
Right?
So the idea of this was to build bridges.
So part of it was about building bridges, and part of it was just about creating healing spaces. And I think we've seen kind of an evolution, for folks who felt deeply threatened by both the rhetoric and the language and actual visceral rises in hate crimes and violence in the streets, right? And that there was this desire to be, and I guess when I use the kind of word safety, right, the thing that actually indicates whether or not somebody's going to show up to a table into a community, particularly one of strangers, is whether or not they feel safe in that space. And I think that there's a tension point between how we define safety and recognizing that there is still courage in showing up and listening deeply, right, and putting on hold the presumptions that we make of one another.
Right.
But that sense, I think particularly in the early days of the election, when people were just carrying a lot of grief, there was a need for ritual and beauty and a space to rest and to breathe. And I think as we get into a point where a lot of folks are feeling deeply burned out and kind of recognizing, for those on the front lines of a lot of progressive work in the world, that this is a long game, right? And the reparation of, the crisis in relationships as one that isn't going to be solved within one administration. It's not going to be solved by policies, right? So we need spaces in which we can restore ourselves and rejuvenate. And then I think that there's the other impulse and desire to build bridging spaces, right? That very intentionally place us outside of our comfort zone, outside of the people and the circles
with whom we know and already have that kind of established trust and get to hear each other.
How do you get groups like that together?
Well, Lennon, what you were just talking about reminded me of a woman named Linda who's in, oh gosh, Columbia, Tennessee, or Cleveland, Tennessee. There's a woman named Linda who is a long
Tennessee.
I'm just trying. I don't really leave the Nashville bubble, unfortunately. I don't think it's Cleveland. I think it's Columbia.
Yeah.
Linda, who's in Columbia, Tennessee, she's an educator who just retired 30 years as a middle school principal and teacher. And then the kind of aftermath of the election had this impulse to want to get intentional about building relationships with people in the post-election moment. And so she started gathering with a group of women across the political spectrum to ask this question, what would it take for us to begin repairing our relationships in our communities? And she found the People Supper and came to one of our dinners, and that small group of five folks now is 25 folks in the heart of a red state. And so it's interesting.
And are there differing opinions
and
in their, that red state? That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult to find a lot of diversity at times.
I had coffee with Linda last week, and she said to me, people left that space and didn't know that half of them were Trump voters and half of them were Clinton voters. And it was because of the deep rootedness of story and story sharing in that space that it didn't occur to them that someone that on face value, right, they would completely dismiss, they could build this deep connectivity to.
Right.
And so that work of bridging, I think, is really important, even as a healing process in some ways. Like, it's through that bridging sometimes that we can begin to see each other again and broaden our own imagination.
I remember Emily called me after one of the early suppers in the campaign where there was political diversity in Brooklyn, New York.
Not the easiest place to necessarily find political diversity.
We found a Trump voter in a bar. Right, so I will have you know. And we invited her to dinner.
And she came. And people were willing to listen.
Oh, yeah.
And talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Are the conversations, or what are the conversations? Are they political, or how do these conversations go? How do the dinners go?
Let me ask you this.
What's the intent? What was the intent behind how you wanted the dinners to be?
We wanted people to see each other as people, first and foremost.
Easier said than done.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we wanted to dig deeper than just like, oh, here's all your political beliefs and all the 18 different news articles that you've shared on social media this week. And here's, you know, your opinions about what happened yesterday. We wanted to dig into actually, who are you? What are you about? What do you care about? And I think that that work is best done by storytelling. But each of us, I don't care what your political alignment is or your background, each of us has a moment in which we've been harassed or discriminated against or treated as less than. And so when we do these dinners around bridging difference, that is one of the first questions at the starting gate, because all of us align on that. What is harder to align on is the next question, which is about what is a moment in which you felt truly seen and loved and heard in a space. What's painfully surprising is that that is much harder for people to come to. Mm-hmm. It is much harder for people to tell that story than it is to tell a story in which they've been harassed or treated as less than.
It feels like my expectation, certainly when I saw the idea of the dinners, I thought you would sit down and start having conversations about politics.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't. You want to stay away from that. Why?
I think we've been so trained to become our own pundits in some ways that starting from a place of debating politics or debating issues rather than story automatically puts people's walls up, automatically places them in sort of a defensive posture.
It's like starting from the head.
It's starting from the head instead of the heart. Because I think in the long term, and we've had groups that have continued to host dinners over time, the conversations might go there. Mm-hmm. But first you have to develop a layer of trust with one another to know that this person sitting across from me with cookies on the table, that person's not going to attack me.
Right.
And I can trust that you know and you see me as a person first and not just as my voter identification.
We have to be able to have a civil conversation before we can actually discuss the tough things. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think that we have to, I mean, see each other for, like, the extraordinary human journeys that got every single person to sit to the seats around that table, right? Like, we have to be able to recognize each other for the strength, the resilience, the hurt that every person carries, right? That's part of the universal human story. And so, and I think, you know, our goal is not to change each other's mind, but I also think that in hearing stories that you don't otherwise encounter from people that you wouldn't otherwise encounter, right, you begin to change your assumptions of other, right? Your assumptions of this person. It doesn't necessarily change your own beliefs or your voting habits, and that's not our goal, right? Our goal is to change the expectation of judgment and the instinct that we have to assume the worst in somebody else.
And I think, you know, of the three of us, I was probably the biggest skeptic of all of this. I mean, because they come from a faith organization and a grieving organization. You know, they're in these, like, spiritual spaces all the time. I'm the harassment girl over here. And so... I just talk about violence all day long, you know? And so it was like, is a dinner going to make a difference, right? And I think a lot of people have that skepticism. Is a dinner going to change anything? We're not even talking about politics. What are you going to change if you're not telling to talk about policy? And
so does a dinner make a difference?
A dinner makes a difference. I have to say, and I do not say this lightly, I have to say the first dinner that I went to, I pretty confident that my heart changed shape. There's something about it. There's something about sitting down with people, and there's something about the urgency that we all had to go so deep into these really real stories. I told stories that I've told almost no one with these people because I felt the urgency of being seen in that moment and of opening up space for other people to be seen. And we heard stories from, you know, non-custodial moms who missed their kids. We heard stories from a guy who whose brother, you know, died in his crib. We heard stories from, you know, people who never really felt safe in public school because they were the only immigrant. They were the only Muslim, right? And there was something about that moment and that urgency where I was like, the world is different when I walked out that door than it is when I went in it. And I don't. It was magic. It truly was. It was magic.
Just in listening to you talk about the emotion, is there something to this that when people converse and have a conversation, maybe can relate on an emotional level? It's a little bit harder to have some of that hate speech or that lack of understanding.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I mean, there's even data around empathy, right? And when we see the way that somebody is relating to something, when we see their emotions, we feel them in a deeper way. And you can't see all of that online. You can't feel all of that. And I think it makes it harder. Now, it doesn't make it impossible. Obviously, harassment still happens in all of these contexts, in all kinds of different public spaces. But it's very hard to do it when you've really seen somebody's heart in a meaningful way. And that's what we're trying to do. Not just get people to sit in the same room and talk about whatever, right? But to get people to sit in the same room and look at each other's hearts and look at their own.
And then maybe you can find some understanding or at least be able to have a conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think vulnerability is the gateway to empathy, right? And which is complicated because it means that the subjects that we never ever talk about, because being vulnerable is hard, courageous work, is actually the stuff that is most powerful in its capacity to help us understand each other, right? And at least to be willing to welcome you to a table, even with and while holding the differences that distinguish who we are.
It's countercultural.
Yeah.
Our culture and our society today tells us that we are to be individualistic, that we're supposed to pursue a singular sort of vision of success, and it's just about me and my family. And I think what we're trying to do is go back to a more ancient way of doing community together and seeing one another. I don't know that one dinner is going to change the world, but I do think it has the potential to transform one heart. And that heart might just the next
change
time,
the world.
Might just change the world. The next time they see someone being harassed in the street, that's those stories come back, and maybe they'll stand up and say that that's wrong. You never know. But it's powerful.
Yeah, I think it's so easy to make assumptions about people you don't know, right? And when you actually think about it, the people that we don't know are far greater in number than just strangers and people you've never met, right? There are people that we interact with on a daily basis, right? They're neighbors whose first names we know, but very little about their stories if we know their first names, right? There are people that we've known for years and we haven't actually heard about where they come from and what brought them into being, right? The whys we believe, the things that we believe, rather than the whats we believe. Right. And I think that that's what's so important.
When you're putting the dinners together, are you looking for specific diversity that you want it to be gender diverse or politically diverse or ethnically diverse? How do you try to decide, or what is the goal when you look for the diversity of the dinners?
Yeah, so one of our big goals, again, if it's a bridge building supper, and that's the kind of experience that people are looking to have, is to match people in a very kind of intentional way who carry different lived experiences and different identities across racial lines, across ethnic and cultural lines, across generational lines. The innumerable sources of segregation that we still tolerate in this society, right? Part of the intention is what is bringing people to the table is a desire to break out of that, but oftentimes they don't know who to gather, right? And so a lot of our work is about matching people who reach out to us in the same city or town, who come from different places and wouldn't otherwise have a chance to meet.
Yeah.
And then it's also interesting because a lot of our work, too, is about actually giving people language and tools and templates through which they can extend the invitation to people that they might know via 1 or 2 degrees of separation, or might not have ever had a real kind of conversation with. So what is the language that's going to bring that person to the table, and what do you do when they get there to actually establish that connection?
Have you found it, and I know just in talking with you, have you found it harder to find some of the diversity in certain pockets of the country?
Yes.
Where may I ask?
I think that interestingly, progressives have been a lot more interested in showing up at the table than conservatives, which isn't always the case. A lot of times in elections, usually the people that won are the people who are the most eager to extend and to bridge build, than the people who lost an election. And I think that that's like an interesting challenge, that we're continuing to look at and to figure out.
So how do you figure that out, and how do you get more conservatives then to the table to really add to that diversity?
Can you not move your chain?
Sorry.
So many rules. The people suffer isn't like this. So how do you, the last thing I asked you, so how do you find that diversity in political thought, I guess, how do you find the conservatives and get them to the table if there are more progressives out there?
So I think part of one of the things that's been surprising that we found is that actually, so the first instinct that everyone says is, I don't know anyone, right? And then they actually take a pause and a breath and they're like, well, actually, I do. I've got this, cousin or family friend or somebody that I've, met in a grocery store, whatever it happens to be, right? And oftentimes it's 1 or 2 degrees of separation. The thing that invites, one of the things that we're finding that, determines whether or not conservatives feel safe showing up in these conversations, and oftentimes because they fear, right, that what we're going to be talking about is politics, and this is a vehicle through which progressives are going to convince them to change their beliefs, right?
Or
which
just attack that, them.
Or just be under attack, right? And the number of people who fear being under attack right now is everyone.
Everyone. It's been so surprising.
And so the thing that actually gets somebody to a table is that they trust the person that extended the invitation, or they trust somebody else who's there, right? So a lot of our work is about, here's the language that you can use to forward on to a friend who can then forward it on to their friend, right? Or invite a friend. I love... there was a supper in Staunton, Virginia, that brought together 200 people, actually. So they did a really big gathering, all at smaller tables.
And the invitation was, if you know somebody who believes something different from you, that's the person you bring to supper. Okay? And yeah. It worked, you know. I think we do know people. It's just that we fear each other and fear extending that invitation. But there is, I think, one of the things that's been really deeply gratifying in this experience, and the reason that we fear it, right, is because we fear all the things that could go wrong, yeah. right? And one of the things that's been so gratifying in this is to see again and again and again, it doesn't happen, right? Those fears are misplaced and misguided, mm-hmm. and that when you ask the right questions, right, people really do open up and listen to each other differently.
So how do you ask the right questions?
You ask questions that are open-hearted and open-ended that you don't know the answer to. Mm-hmm. So often when we ask one another questions, it's about figuring out what the person's going to say in response. And one of the things that we learn from the folks at the Center for Courage and Renewal is that there's something about asking a question that you honestly don't know the answer to and you deeply desire to hear. And so that work of stepping outside of what I think is sort of our practice of asking to get what we want out of people, and then instead asking to build relationship with folks,
yeah.
is, mm-hmm. it's sad to say that that's revolutionary in this moment,
yeah.
but at a time when people yell at each other all the time.
And I feel like people are looking at this as like, well, if the other side just had more education,
exactly,
you know, then they would understand. They would have my political belief if they just had more education. And this is actually taking a different approach. It's like maybe it's not about having more education. Maybe it's just about having these stories and more clarity about how we see and we feel and what our lived experience is. And it really takes education, a sort of like top-down approach to education, and instead it's a conversation, which is a bottom-up approach to education. And I think that's what works, because if you had to go to a seminar about anything before going to dinner, you probably wouldn't go, right? But if you just got to go to dinner and you just got to see people and hear people's stories, then you start to show up and you start to build those relationships that then maybe down the road make you want to go to the seminar.
You have all the hosts. What's a host for dinner tasked with?
So there's a few things. but, you know, actually a big part of our goal and one of the things that we found is that people don't think that they're ready, right? You're not an expert facilitator. So what a host isn't, right, is an expert, right? A host is not a life coach. A host is certainly not an advocate, right? And present at a table for the purposes of influencing, right? A host is somebody who can set a date in the calendar and, you know, organize the potluck spreadsheet, figure out who's bringing what. Though we've had a few suppers of all dessert, and those work fine.
It's not the problem with that. Nothing right.
Ain't nobody gonna complain.
Here we are.
so that's one piece, the kind of like organizing. Two is you want somebody who's actually creating really intentional physical space, right? Who's gonna put in that little extra bit of care that when you show up on a stranger's doorstep, which is scary work, right? And there is nobody who has done that act, who has not had the moment of butterflies in your stomach of like, is this a good idea? Could I just stay home and Netflix, right? And so you want somebody who's put in that little bit of care so that when you walk into the space, they feel warm and they feel welcome, right? Somebody who's an accustomed host and connector and likes bringing people together because it signals that there's somebody who's able to make people feel comfortable, yeah. right? And that's how we drop the defenses, right? Mm-hmm. And drop kind of our guard and our assumptions of one another and step into a space of shared vulnerability. And then finally, just somebody who's capable of both bringing their own authenticity into a conversation and of actually listening, right? And connecting dots across a table as a facilitator.
Mm. If you had to, I feel like so many groups have like a tagline. Mm-hmm. If you, and this might take a minute for you to think of, but if you had to give, you know, the People's Supper and give it sort of that tagline, whether it's the People's Supper is, what is that People's Supper tagline?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. People's Supper. Get down, get vulnerable, eat.
You know, it's summertime.
Good food, good people, good conversations.
Yeah.
Dig in.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like in all of that, not a mention of you're learning about other people. You're bridging a gap even. But somehow that's coming out of all of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it, and it's because people so naturally want it. They're naturally hungry for it. You know, I remember the very first dinner that I hosted was in my living room. And I just was so nervous getting ready for it. And I was reading through all these guides that Jen and Lennon had written because they are amazing writers and experts in all this, and I am not. And I'm like, oh God, then what do I say? And then what happens if the whole thing explodes? And then, you know, and how do I, like, you know, keep the conversation going but honor people's experiences and all this stuff, right? And I'm sitting on the floor in my bathroom watching my kid take a bath while I'm making all this happen. And then I did it. And it was just, it was much more simple and natural than I think I thought it might be. Like, I so wanted it to be perfect, mm-hmm. but the reality was is that every single person who showed up there wanted it to be perfect. And so they brought what their closest approximation to what perfect was going to look like yeah. to that dinner, and collectively, it was perfect. It was perfect, but it wasn't because I had some facilitation superpower or I'd been doing this work for 10 plus years. It was just because of the intention of people who truly and deeply want this in this moment.
You guys are, I mean, right now we're, what, 9 months out of the election, I think? I mean, this was born of the election year and the election cycle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At this point, do you think you've been successful?
Yeah, well, you know, so when this was first kind of cooked up, the intention was to do nothing more than 100 days, right? So we set ourselves what felt like a very big goal of 100 suppers in 100 days, yeah. right? And we hit that, and we exceeded it. And we ended up having a little over 140 in the first 100 days of that new administration. And I think part of what's been extraordinary is that it's continued, right? And so we've had over 200 suppers that we ourselves have curated. We've helped share tools and guidelines with an additional gathering of, you know, more than 500 suppers on one day back in June in partnership with some friends of ours with Dream Defenders and a coalition of partner organizations. And, you know, what we're finding again and again and again is that people do want to keep gathering. They just don't know how, and they don't know with whom, mm-hmm. right? And there we can help.
Mm-hmm. So you've been successful.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is holy work. It's sacred work. Yeah. I'm a church girl because it feels like God's work of what it means to build community and be human with one another and see the sacred spark. So if we had had one dinner, I would have been like, success. And nobody ended up throwing, you know, the other person out or throwing something at someone else. Success. So it's just really been an honor to work with these humans who are tremendous. Tremendous souls and who I learn from each and every day. And I'm a better person because I've known you. And
me
you.
Too.
Well, you guys are also helping change, as you said, hearts. Mm-hmm. You certainly changed at least one heart. You said if you change one heart. And Emily, you said it changed yours.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's true. Although we did not start this initiative to change my heart. Thanks, guys.
Done. Check. And you guys are, it's across the country, right? If anybody wanted to, you guys are, this isn't just about doing it coastal.
Yeah.
This
right.
It's all over.
All so, over the country.
It is remarkable. We've had suppers in now more than 50 cities across the country, I think somewhere close to 20 states. And we've heard from people who are looking to gather in more than 375 cities and towns across the country, most of them places that we've never heard of, right? And that's part of what's been so life-giving and inspiring about this is that, you know, we might not know who to connect in Columbia, Tennessee. Actually, we do. But, like, if you're reaching out from a place, you know, where we haven't heard from others, what we can do is help you equip you with tools and with language so that you can extend the reach and the invitation to people that you already know who are part of that community. And I think part of what we're finding is that a lot of work, you know, when it's you're waiting for a program or some institution, you know, to solve something for you, right, or to step in, right? If you live in isolated places, there's no one there to do that work. And so part of what our work is about giving people the tools and the self-permission to be those hosts.
curious, have you had any dinners that you've heard that have gone bad? I mean, we joke like, you know, we had a dinner and nobody threw anyone out, but have you had dinners where...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the most common kind of complaint is not that anybody got into a fight, thank God.
Right. Not yet. Knock on wood.
But I think sometimes it's awkward, right? It's awkward because we're accustomed to having these conversations. We can go immediately into talking about this post-election moment, wherever it is that you come from, right? Because all of us are immersed in those conversations every day and in the headlines, right? And actually bringing in a different kind of intention, right? Asking a different set of questions, you know? You might get the moment of pause in a conversation where there's silence, right? And so part of our work is about actually giving people permission to hold that silence. That silence is okay, right? And you don't have to leave a supper best friends with everyone, right? Because oftentimes, you know, relationships can be born of finding and discovering shared affinity, right, and commonality. And sometimes that comes up around a supper. And sometimes we realize, wow, we're really different people with really different lives, and that's okay, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, look at us, right? We're, like, the harassment organization, the faith organization, the grief organization. Like, organizations like this don't just come up with collaborations on the daily. I mean, there's something about this moment that necessitates this and makes this feel really obvious and natural, but also requires, like, jumping some, like, divides in terms of how our different fields work, in terms of how our, you know, our organizations work. But I think what's beautiful about it is that it's values aligned. So if we can do it, the rest of America can do it.
What's next? What do you see coming next for this, or what's just next in general for the People's Supper?
Comment on that one.
We have plans.
We do.
We don't know if anybody's going to fund them, but we have them.
What do you want to do? You've had success at what the original goal was, and obviously exceeded that. So what do you want to do? Where can this go?
Yeah, so, well, I think it's a couple of things. One of the things that we've found is that people actually want to keep gathering, right? And so not only people want to keep gathering beyond the original time stamp of a campaign that we thought was going to be 100 days, and surprise, we're going to keep it going. But that people actually, once they have these moments and surprising connections and conversations with one another, they want to keep gathering with the same group, right? And so what are the tools that allow you to take those relationships and that kind of place of trust and actually engage some of the harder conversations and harder work of understanding the values that we carry and why we believe the things that we believe and the systems that we're a part of, right? And work that can't be done if you leap immediately into it with an agenda, because we'll all immediately close up. So that's part of what we're working on, is developing tools that enable that ongoing kind of connection and also the work in the world to flow. And then part of what we're finding is the innumerable adaptations of this set of principles and processes that can enable a lot of different kinds of conversations for a lot of different partner organizations and spaces that are simply seeking to speak and to connect differently.
Right.
So that's been a big part of the work that Jen and Emily and all of our teams have been leading.
And that you had mentioned, was that one of the Muslim organizations that you had mentioned also?
You want to talk to that?
Yeah, so we've been partnering with a number of faith groups, including an organization called WISE, which is a group of Muslim women who across the country are seeking to create spaces for people to get to know them, not just for those who wear the veil because they wear hijab, right? Not just what they hear in the news reports about Islam and its oppression of women, but really seeking to get to know their neighbors. And so part of our partnership with them has been thinking about, what would it look like to gather? We had this idea, coffee meets tea, right? Because in many countries in the Muslim world, it's not coffee, it's tea that people drink. To build relationship and connection beyond the headlines in a very interpersonal way.
It's really fun. Like, I'm listening to you. It all revolves around a little food,
yeah,
a beverage.
Yeah.
And suddenly maybe you can just have a conversation and learn something.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, the movement of our time is not a movement for or against President Trump, right? The movement of our time is a movement for each other and what we're engaging in long term, whether it's, you know, whether it's dinners or something else, is trying to figure out how can we look at each other and see each other as human. And how can we do that in a way that we can scale that love to everyone so that everyone has the opportunity both to look and to see each other and also to be fully seen and heard?
Some of it, you know, as you mentioned, it's not, take the presidential race out of it. Discourse in our country has changed a lot. Is some of this a response not just to the politics of our country, but discourse, be it on social media or in person or on television?
People aren't nice anymore. And I say that as somebody who grew up in the Midwest, where niceness has a certain capital, but people don't know how to treat each other decently anymore, because that's not what we hear, that's not what we see, and we've begun to live into some of our worst instincts. And so I think part of our work is thinking about what does it mean for us to be nice, not like in a way that's divorced of our own values or morals, but like just not being a jerk is like something that I don't know why, but it has become a rarity.
It's a core value.
It's a core value. Core value. Don't be a jerk.
But also, don't be nice in a way that's just, I mean, that's just sort of a shroud over mean and hateful comments, right? Like, I'm from the South, and I've heard people be all kinds of sweetie, honey, you know, all this stuff, right? And then under that is a heavy layer of racism and sexism and everything in between. And, you know, and I think that in some ways what we've seen is that maybe it's not that people, the shroud of niceness is missing, right? But maybe that's what it takes to uncover what's underneath it so that we can see it and move from it and learn from it and change it, you know? So that when we say nice, we mean it in an authentic way. We mean it in the way that Jen says it, not in the way that that we, you know, oh, sweetie, that's so nice.
Niceness has been used. We associate niceness with covering up, right? And I think that it is possible to speak truth, to name truth, our own, and to hear others, and still be welcoming, right? And still hold a measure of decency to one another. I also think that in this moment, you know, so there's the kind of polarization and vitriol and, you know, decline in just our discourse. But there's also this problem of social isolation, right? And one stat that has always stood out to me is in 1985, it was something like 1 in 10 Americans didn't have somebody with whom they could share important stuff, right? By 2004, that number was 1 in 4. And we can know the trend and the trajectory that that has continued to take in this modern moment. And so for even people who are surrounded, you know, by strangers or continually connected on the internet, right? There is still this deep, universally shared experience of feeling unknown and unseen, right? And that's something that isn't going to be fixed in a policy. It's actually about the only mechanism that we know to solve that issue is the single thing that humans have been doing since the dawn of humankind, right? Of gathering with one another.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.